This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the relationship between teacher diversity and student success in the classroom. But first, let's look inside the boardroom. In the U.S., men named John, James, Robert, and William hold more corporate board seats than women hold altogether. Just let that sink in for a moment. It's a pretty striking reality that begs the question, why aren't there more women in corporate America? In countries like Norway, Germany, and France, quotas help to provide a better balance and might overall provide a better level of corporate governance. Today, we'll take a look at what's driving the lack of gender balance and why it matters to American business. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us from Stanford University is Aaron Deer, who's a professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School and a visiting scholar at Yale Law School. He's the author of Challenging Boardroom Homogeneity, Corporate Law, Governance, and Diversity. He also wrote a big piece in The Atlantic on this issue. And Aaron, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us from NPR headquarters in Washington is Laura Liswood, who's Secretary General of the Council of Women World Leaders. She's also the author of The Loudest Duck, Moving Beyond Diversity. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
First of all, Aaron, let's just talk about the big issue that we're looking at here. The overall percentage of women in boardrooms, there's a lot of ways to break it down. We use the statistic about just men named John and William at the top. But maybe you can give us some stark numbers that will help us understand just how big the imbalance is.
Yeah, I mean, the imbalance is striking. When you look at Norway, where there's approximately 40% women on board, and then you look at the United States, where it's a different story altogether. And I think that there are probably a few different explanations for the stark numbers. First, perhaps there's a pool problem. Perhaps there's a shortage of women who are qualified to be directors. Second, maybe there's a sufficient pool of qualified women, but they're just not interested in directorships. Maybe they're opting out or they're not inclined to actively pursue board appointments. Or third, I mean, maybe a sufficient pool of qualified, interested women does exist, but they're just not being selected. So if these are the possibilities, which is it? My own view after writing this book is that a significant part of the problem relates to unconscious bias in the board appointment process, along with closed networks. And there's a really interesting study done by researchers at Harvard Business School. They surveyed 1,000 board members from 58 countries, including the U.S. And interestingly, they found that men tend to attribute the gender imbalance to a perceived pool problem, whereas women, on the other hand, are more likely to explain it as a function of established male networks that are just really tough to break into.
So break those two apart for us. Unconscious bias and closed networks are both problems that we see all throughout the business world. But the unconscious bias piece is very interesting. I mean, how exactly does this reflect itself?
Well, if you think a little bit about how corporate board nominees are recruited, firms use a range of methods, but one of the most important is to tap into the social and economic networks of the existing board members and the existing executives. And when you have that kind of informal process, it's natural that the subjective biases that affect all of us in society more generally will come into play. So there's a wealth of social science research that tells us that we have a tendency towards bias, in particular, the assumption that men are more effective leaders than women. And then at the same time, the research tells us that we have a tendency to form networks that consists of others who are socially similar to ourselves. So the fact that firms and their nominating committees are likely to recruit new members from existing networks, and that these networks tend to be homogeneous and tough to break into, that likely leads to an appointment process that's not as inclusive as we might hope.
So, Laura, let's pull apart some of these various theories that Aaron threw out there. The idea that people think there aren't enough qualified female candidates, that the women who maybe are qualified just aren't showing up on people's radars. What are the most likely explanations that you see?
Well, I think Aaron has done a good job of saying, okay, what are the possibilities? I think the probability is the ones that Aaron has articulated at the end, which is that they're not being selected. I mean, there are several groups in the United States and globally that have already assembled the pool of very qualified women who could be potential candidates and potentially chosen for boards, but somehow they don't get into the consideration. And I would go along with Aaron saying this is probably people's perception of what a leader looks like and these closed networks of people who don't know people And like certainly gravitates to like. And, you know, I think, you know, most of us do have that sense of wanting to be around people who we're congenial with, wanting to be around people we can bond with, that we think we have same common experiences with, and that this kind of, quote, disruption of that sort of homogeneous environment is something that people resist, particularly if there's no legal constraints to prevent them from that.
We're talking with Aaron Deer and Laura Liswood. Laura, we've done programs in the past talking about women CEOs and how there's a lack of leadership at the top in America. We've done programs about the pay gap, the persistent 77 or 78 cents on a dollar that a woman makes compared to a man. Is this question about corporate governance on boards, is it part of the same problem, part of the same issue, or is there something slightly different about the conversation we're having today?
Well, I think it probably includes this issue of the fact that in most corporations these days, at least within the United States, there's not what I call an intake problem. In other words, women are coming into organizations, you know, representative of their percentages in coming out of colleges, et cetera. But there's an upgrade problem that they can't quite make it to the top for a variety of reasons. And there's a lot of gatekeepers that come along. You know, Catalyst has plenty of research that talks about how men are evaluated on potential and women are evaluated on performance. The statistic I love comes from Malcolm Gladwell, where he talks about the fact that 16% of men in the United States are 6 feet or taller, and 57% of Fortune 500 male CEOs are 6 feet or taller. And I've done plenty of research on this, and Aaron has too. I've never seen any research that correlates leadership ability and skeletal structure.
Yeah, and as you say it, it sounds absolutely ridiculous, but yet it plays itself out on a day-to-day basis. Aaron, pick up on this upgrade problem, this ability for women to get into the business world but then not rise to the level that either puts them in the CEO's chair or puts them on a corporate board.
Well, and it's exactly for this reason that countries around the world are starting to turn to the force of law in order to correct this problem, realizing that the problem is not correcting itself. And so essentially, we've seen countries enact two forms of legal regulation in order to address it. First, quotas, which in their strongest form require particular levels of gender balance in the boardroom. We see this in countries such as Norway, Italy, France, Belgium, Iceland, and just this March, Germany. Norway was the first country to take this path, and so in the book I use it as a case study. Under the Norwegian law, the required level of representation, it depends on the size of the board. So, for example, if you have 9 directors on your board, then both sexes must make up at least 40% of the board. And it's fascinating. If countries don't comply, the state has the ability to step in and dissolve the firm. And that is by far the strongest sanction under any quota law.
Before we get to the unlikely possibility that laws like that might work in the United States, let's talk a little bit more about Norway. This quota was pretty controversial when it went into place, Aaron.
Yeah, it was very controversial, and it's interesting. So in order to understand how it works, I conducted in-depth interviews with corporate directors in Norway, both male and female, about their lived experiences under the quota. And most of the directors I interviewed told me that initially they were against the quota, but it was only after seeing the law in action and then directly experiencing its effects that they slowly came to change their minds.
Well, let's talk about the effects. Why is this a good thing? Obviously, we want to see gender balance for a lot of reasons that just have to do with equity. But when it gets right down to it, does it make for better business?
Well, I think it depends on how we think about better business. What does that mean exactly? So for the directors that I interviewed, they didn't talk a lot about tying diversity to traditional performance metrics like return on equity, return on assets, etc. Rather, they talked about the improved quality of board decision-making and overall governance. They were of the view, for example, that women were more likely to thoroughly deliberate and evaluate risks, that they showed a greater tendency to engage with corporate management and to curb the tendency towards groupthink. And in thinking about why that might be the case, many of the directors I interviewed attributed it to women's status as outsiders to the boardroom and the male networks that usually form it. They were seen as more independent as a result of this status. And many also felt that women introduced new viewpoints and perspectives that came from their own different experiences. And I think that those findings are in line with other studies that suggest that, in general, diverse groups tend to do a better job than homogeneous ones when they're tackling complicated issues.
We've seen, Laura, in the past, certainly after the big Wall Street collapse, that there have been some studies done about female executives maybe taking a look at risk quite a bit differently than male executives, maybe thinking things through and deliberating more carefully. If we had more female CEOs, this study postulated, we wouldn't have maybe had the type of Wall Street collapse that we did. Do you see some of that in the anecdotes or the hard data that Aaron and others have been collecting?
Yes, we do. In fact, quite a long time ago, I had actually been quoted as saying that, you know, we'd have been better off if it had been Lehman Brothers and sisters. Because what you're talking about is not to the exclusion of either, because you don't want a homogeneous group of all women. But you do want people who have more of a risk orientation, less of a risk orientation, more of a short-term look, more of a long-term look. You want them both. That's the value of diversity. And certainly there has been some research on hedge funds that indicate that women do have less risk orientation. And it's sort of one of those things which they say, basically, if you want to have large gains and potential large losses, then you probably want to have a male hedge fund manager. If you want to sleep at night, you probably want a female hedge fund manager who will modulate the risk somewhat.
You know, Aaron also talks, Laura, about this outsider role, and that's something that a woman, maybe somebody from a different socioeconomic background could bring, somebody from a racial diverse background could bring. The idea that, well, we call them yes men for a reason, right? People all line up behind the big boss and say what he usually wants to hear. An outsider of any type might shake things up, might make for just a healthier conversation in the boardroom.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think you're talking about historically overrepresented groups and historically underrepresented groups. You're talking about dominant groups and non-dominant groups. So it's both gender, but it's also potentially other groups who do have a different orientation. I think it is fascinating, Catherine Phillips' work out of Columbia, where she basically says that homogeneous groups don't come to better solutions. They just think they did. Heterogeneous groups come to better solutions. They just don't think they did.
We're talking about the importance of diversity in the boardroom, later in the classroom here on Where We Live. Let's go to AJ, who's calling from Stanford today. Hi there, AJ. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I am the first black man hired, even on a part-time basis, in the history of the English department at Norwalk Community College, an institution that touts itself as being a model of diversity. And, of course, there's student body diversity, but the faculty for the student body, but for the faculty, there is little or no diversity. And I was hired as late as 2007. Now, at Norwalk Community College, there's a policy whereas the African-Americans and Latino professional teachers are usually hired on part-time basis, whereas the white females, you know, are usually hired on a full-time basis due to the makeup of the search committees. 2 out of 102, and those two, one is a black female and one is a black male. That's desegregation. That's not diversity. The last day of hiring, there were 6 white females and 1 white male. African-American professors, that there are only there's no more than 18 African American professional staff, no black deans or department chairs, and virtually no professional or managerial or executive presence of Hispanics or Latinos, despite the astounding diversity of the student body, many of whom were born internationally and who are being served. Now, for black applicants, the majority of white search committees focus on the most mundane clerical functions rather than things like publications, teaching background, et cetera, and they weed out the applicants of color, and they can tell who's who by one's resume. They can tell what your race is. Now, the issue of diversity in higher education is the same, if not more important, as equality of opportunity in America's newsrooms, boardrooms, and war rooms. But the campus workplace at NCC is reflective of a culture of exclusion rife with cronyism, scholastic lynchings, rampant nepotism, and unbenign neglect of Hispanics, Latinos, and African Americans, especially African American males.
And AJ, I'm gonna let you go, and I appreciate your phone call very much and for making that important point. And later on in the program, we're going to be talking more specifically about the classroom. But I guess before we take a break, Aaron, I'd like you to maybe address some of what AJ just had to say. He's coming from an educational background, and he's talking about diversity that goes beyond gender diversity. But a lot of things he brings up actually get to the point of American business. I mean, the quality of diversity in how you make decisions in business has an awful lot to do with the customers you serve, with the way in which people who work in the company actually interact with management. I mean, these things are all really, really important. And it seems like we're still, after decades of talking about this stuff, still struggling with ways to change it.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And it gets to sort of the issue of, well, why exactly do we value diversity? And taking it away from the sort of traditional, as I talked about before, business case, and thinking about our underlying theory of the corporation. And at the end of the day, the corporation is a very powerful social institution. And if you think about the statistics, for example, just the fact under 3% of Fortune 500 directors are women of color, then you really have to stop and think hard about whether or not corporations, these important dominant social institutions, are reflective of the communities in which they operate.
We're talking with Aaron Deer, who's a professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School. He's also a visiting scholar at Yale Law School. Challenging Boardroom Homogeneity, a symposium and book launch, takes place on May 21st at Yale Law School in New Haven. Find out more by visiting law.yale.edu. We're also talking with Laura Liswood, whose book is The Loudest Duck, Moving Beyond Diversity. We're going to take more of your phone calls as we talk about diversity in the boardroom and later in the classroom here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Women hold just 15% of the seats on the boards of the S&P 1500, a mere 3.7% over the last 7 years. There's a lot in this article in The Atlantic by Aaron Deer, who's a professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School and visiting scholar at Yale Law School. It's what Norway can teach the U.S. about getting more women into boardrooms. This is part of a book of his called Challenging Boardroom Homogeneity, Corporate Law, Governance, and Diversity. We're talking about these issues today, and we're also going to be talking about diversity in the classroom coming up later on. We're also joined by Laura Liswood, who's Secretary General of the Council of Women World Leaders, also the author of The Loudest Duck, Moving Beyond Diversity While Embracing Differences to Achieve Success at Work. Aaron, as you did the study on Norway and how they get more women into corporate boardrooms, they use a pretty strict quota system, something that, well, maybe it got off to a controversial start, but now it seems to be gaining some traction. The idea of a quota is something that a lot of European countries might be able to do. Does this work at all in the U.S.?
Well, it's important to think about what is the legal situation in the U.S. to begin with. Since 2010, the Securities and Exchange Commission has required companies to disclose whether they consider. So, and I mentioned before, there's two main forms of legal regulation. I should back up for a second and say the second is disclosure. So since 2010, the SEC has asked firms to disclose whether they consider diversity when composing their boards, and if so, how. But what's interesting is the SEC rule doesn't define diversity, and it leaves it to companies to give the term meaning. And so in the book, I studied the disclosures of the S&P 100 over the first 4 years of the rule. And the most important finding from my study is that American companies do, in fact, disclose that they consider diversity when composing their boards. But the question is, how do they define diversity? And what's interesting on that front is that only about half of the companies I studied define diversity to include sociodemographic characteristics like gender, like race. Firms are much more likely to think of diversity as involving diversity of background, diversity of experience. So a typical disclosure might be something along the lines of, diversity is very important to us, and we strive to have a diverse board that has a range of experience in government, in industry, in business more generally, etc. In terms of the quota solution, I think it's important to avoid falling into the trap of thinking that there's a one-size-fits-all solution here. There isn't. As you mentioned, the quota solution is a very, very austere one, and I think different levels of government intervention will be tolerable in different settings. In the U.S., quotas likely face constitutional barriers. They certainly aren't politically viable. And I think a lot does depend on a particular country's sociopolitical culture. So in Norway, for example, unlike the U.S., there is a longstanding tradition of political party quotas, where parties voluntarily agree to meet a specified level of gender representation among their contenders for public office. And that dates back to the mid-1970s. And a number of the directors that I talked to identified that historical context as something that ultimately led to the law being more politically acceptable.
Oh, so if we just change our political system, then everything will fall into place, right? It seems unlikely there. Well, talk about that, Laura. I mean, right now we have these disclosure laws that the SEC has put forward. Do you think that that's something that can be strengthened to change the makeup of U.S. corporate boardrooms? Or do you think that something that looks a little bit more like a European quota system is what we might have to do?
Well, I think that the disclosure by the SEC, the requirement, is a relatively weak strategy for creating any sort of demonstrable social change. What we have in the United States, basically, is what I call the kindness of strangers approach, which is it depends on an individual chairman of a board. It depends on if an institutional investor is putting pressure on a board that has no or very few women. It depends on if the civil society sector is, you know, creating any name and shame kind of approaches to it. That one of the things I think that the U.S. is missing, that even countries like Australia and the U.K. have, which is some sort of governmental strong hand, or at least a guiding hand, where you've got some sort of, you know, comply or explain rules, or if not, why not rules. That at least create more transparency and allow companies to be seen as to what it is that they're doing in terms of the inclusion of diversity on their boards. And you know, we don't even have that at this point. So I'm beginning to think that, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to hurry history. And at the rate we're going, we're going to be at this. You're going to have this conversation in about 80 years, and we're still going to be there.
Well, yeah, and a lot of these conversations that I mentioned earlier, we have been having for a very, very long time, whether it has to do with pay equity or women in the CEO's office. And so this might be one that continues. We have a call here from Laura Jordan. Laura's assistant treasurer for policy for the Connecticut State Treasurer's Office. Laura, thanks for the phone call. What's in your mind? Hi, Laura. Are you there? We'll put Laura on hold, and hopefully we'll hear from Laura in just one moment. So if this has been this long battle, Laura, and we end up with a problem that seems almost intractable, I mean, what do we do? I mean, you say you want to hurry history along. What are some common sense proposals that might make sense?
Well, I think that there are several kind of common sense proposals. Number one, I think there should be a far greater amount of transparency. There are still a number of boards that have no women on them. And that in and of itself should raise questions, although I also agree with AJ, the former call-in person, who does indicate that, you know, this is not just about women. This is historically underrepresented groups. I mean, the car manufacturer will remain nameless, did introduce a car in Mexico called the Nova. And anyone who speaks Spanish knows that Nova means don't go. So sort of for the want of a Spanish speaker, you know, the diversity of that, you know, they made a huge marketing error. And so that's the kind of thing I think, you know, needs to actually be shown with this. You know, we need nudges. Perhaps it could be things like rewarding companies which have a critical mass of diversity on their board that give them an edge on government contracts, possibility of higher taxation for companies that have no diversity on their boards, the idea that Aaron said of ramping up, a kind of a zipper method, which is that every other board member will be a person of diversity. So I think, you know, there are other ways of doing things. Retirement, one of the challenges is that a lot of boards don't turn over very quickly. And so there's not a lot of room for adding a new board member.
Well, okay.
John, if I can...
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Sorry, if I could jump on this. In the book, I give two recommendations for improving the existing SEC rule. And with disclosure, there are just no guarantees. But I think there are some things that can be done. And the first is, as I mentioned, the current rule does not actually give a definition of diversity. And I think that's part of the problem. So the first recommendation is to define diversity as including characteristics such as gender and race. Now, firms would still be free to discuss other forms of diversity that are important to them. That is fine. But that would at least cause firms to think specifically about sociodemographic factors when composing their boards. And then the second recommendation is the one that Laura has discussed before, restructuring the rule to what's known as a comply or explain approach. And just to tease that out a little bit, under that approach, you would require firms to report on whether they adhere to a particular normative but elective set of practices. And if they don't follow the practices, that's fine, but they have to explain why. So, for example, it might look like, do you have a diversity policy? If not, why not? Do you establish measurable objectives when appointing board members, and do you assess your progress in meeting them? If not, why not? Do you make sure to interview diverse candidates and track their success at your firm? And if not, why not? And I think that kind of structure, again, while there are no guarantees, would at least push corporations with a bit more force than the model that's currently in effect.
Do you remember there was some controversy initially about it, what's called the Rooney Rule? Which is for football coaches and
The NFL essentially at the behest of the Rooney family, which owns my beloved Pittsburgh Steelers, said that essentially you had to interview minority candidates for a head coaching job before you arrive at a finalist for the job.
And it's what one of the first and foremost things it did is it raised the visibility of heretofore unknown or little known minority coaches. And that in and of itself had a value.
I want to get back to our phone call here. Laura Jordan is calling from Denise Napier's office. We lost her line a moment ago, but I think she's back on the phone now. Laura, hi there. Thanks for your phone call.
Hi. Thanks for bringing light to this issue this morning.
Sure. Sure. Now, what's on your mind surrounding this?
Well, I just wanted to bring the voice of institutional investors to the conversation. Denise Napier oversees a $30 billion pension plan for the state. And as an investor, she's very aware of the upside of having a non-homogeneous board and bringing diversity to the boards. And so with a coalition of a lot of other institutional investors for the purpose of improving performance, we often file shareholder resolutions asking boards to include women and minorities on their board or improve their practices in terms of vetting candidates. So we've had a lot of success in doing that. We've brought, for example, this year, Monster Beverage, Urban Outfitters. We've had a lot of success in getting boards to improve their nominating procedures.
Yeah, tell me more about the success that you've had, because we've been hearing a lot, Laura, over the course of just the last few years about how institutional investor pressure has gotten companies to change maybe their boardroom behaviors, certainly has changed some of their policies as far as shipping jobs overseas, in part because investor pressure theoretically should be able to do something. Do you actually see some movement here, Laura?
We see movement on quite a number of issues, but certainly on diversity. For example, at Urban Outfitters, it took us 5 years of filing resolutions during the proxy season in order to get them to put an independent woman on the board. And more frequently now, I've seen this in this proxy season, a more awareness of the issue and a willingness to, if not, if they don't have an opening right now on the board, to amend their nominating charter to include women and diversity, women and minorities.
Hmm. Well, Laura, thank you very much for the phone call. I really appreciate your insight here.
Okay, thank you.
Laura Jordan's assistant treasurer for policy at Connecticut's treasurer's office. So, Aaron, talk about that. The last few minutes that we have, I wanted to get to those two issues. One is, can institutional investors or other investors pressure changes in the boardroom, and also just how markets can actually pressure things as well? We've been talking a lot about governmental regulation, but do these two things actually hold some possibilities for change?
Yes, and the focus on my book is on legal regulation, but absolutely the interplay between disclosure, which I talk about, and shareholder advocacy is very important. So Laura mentioned shareholder proposals, and I think that one thing that you'll see is as the disclosure rule becomes stronger, and getting back to Laura Liswood's point, and transparency is abundant, information is more abundant, then I think you'll see correspondingly an increase in the number of shareholder proposals and in their success. At least that's my hope.
Laura Liswood, do you have a thought on that?
I think that given that we pretty much are saying the quota mechanism is probably not the kind of affirmative mechanism that will be, you know, welcome in the United States, then we do have to look at market-based solutions. And I think the institutional investors, given the amount of money, and Denise Napier is very well known for doing this, as is the California treasurer, for, you know, being the, what, 800-pound gorilla in the boardroom with given all of the amount of investment that they have. Individual shareholders can do things, although it's often not so easy for people who are voting proxy to nominate alternative board members, et cetera. So perhaps that's a mechanism for strengthening some of these. But I think the market-based solutions are pretty much the ones that we're going to have to rely upon.
And I think, Laura, a last word from you is the most pure market-based solution is, you know, American women make up a little bit more than 50% of the buying power in the public. And if you factor in a lot of other things, maybe a bit more than 50% of the buying power. Is there just something to the fact that over time, maybe a few more women in corporate boardrooms and then a few more women exercising their pocketbooks in a certain way are going to change the way that we actually have our businesses in America constituted?
Well, certainly that kind of market power has shown to be effective in other places. I mean, look at Thucydides said people change for three reasons and three reasons only: fear, self-interest, or honor. Yeah. So, in terms of American companies, I suspect that fear and self-interest ones are going to be the drivers.
Fear, self-interest, and honor. I'm going to be mulling over that for the rest of the day, actually, in a lot of different things that we have to talk about. Laura Liswood is Secretary General of the Council of Women World Leaders. She's the author of The Loudest Duck, Moving Beyond Diversity. She joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington today. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Aaron Deer, who's professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School, also a visiting scholar at Yale Law School. He'll be taking part in Challenging Boardroom Homogeneity, a symposium and book launch for his book. It'll take place on May 21st at Yale Law School in New Haven. Find out more at law.yale.edu. Aaron, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
We're going to move from the boardroom to the classroom, how more diverse classrooms and more diversity amongst the teaching population might change the way we learn. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We'll be off tomorrow for the 4th of July holiday. Hope you can take the day off, too. You can tune into Hearing Voices, Stars and Bars. We'll be celebrating America with flags, fireworks, and summer festivals featuring recitations and reflections on the Pledge of Allegiance, the annual Rainbow Family migration into the forest on July 4th, a town that covets their title, the Armpit of America. And we'll also hear about Mississippi moonshine, barbecued goat, and some old-time fife and drum. Hope you can join a sound-rich performance of Hearing Voices. It's called Stars and Bars. That's tomorrow's program here on Where We Live. Today, we're taking a look at the relationship between teacher diversity and academic success. Ana Igalite is a postdoctoral fellow in the Program on Education Policy and Governance at Harvard University, also an author of a new study called Representation in the Classroom, the Effect of Own Race, Ethnicity, Teacher Assignment on Student Achievement. She joins us on the phone to talk about her findings from that research. Ana, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me. Thrilled to be with you.
So first of all, I'm wondering if you can just give us some of the big findings, the top takeaways from the study that you did.
Sure. So our study used a data set from the state of Florida, and it was all public school students and teachers over a seven-year time period. And these were grades 3 through 10 students. So this massive data set, 3 million students, 92,000 teachers, and we simply just tracked them over their educational career, and in some years, those students were exposed to teachers that looked like them, and in other years, they had a teacher that was of a different race or ethnicity. And we were curious to see if student achievement in math and in reading on these standardized tests that students take every year would be affected by that exposure. So it's really important, obviously, to control for all kinds of things that we think affect student achievement. You know, things like their background. We control for, you know, their gender, their race, their age, things like this. And also we control for teacher quality by incorporating a value-added measure of that teacher's general effectiveness. So once we've taken care of all of these things that we think influence student achievement, we were able to see that there was still a boost for Black, White, and Asian students, particularly when they were exposed to a teacher that looks like them. So this is a very small effect, but it's present for both math and in reading. And we broke it out to see, well, which age groups are particularly affected by it and which students. And what we found was that it was the elementary age students who were particularly benefiting from this effect, and also those who were lower performing. And we defined that as being in the bottom third of performance for the whole state. And they seem to have a bigger response to being assigned to a teacher that looks like them.
So what are some things we can pull apart from there? Elementary school students fared better than students further along in their education. Do we know why that might be?
Well, I mean, we can certainly hypothesize. When we think about the theories of why teacher diversity might matter, there's things like role model effects that could be at play, and perhaps younger students are just more susceptible to those role modeling effects. It could also be the case that teachers are taking a very active role. You know, when a minority teacher sees a minority student who's struggling, perhaps that triggers something and makes them want to really invest in that student. And it's really hard to tell what it is that's driving them. And that's why the next phase of this research for us will be trying to unpack it a little better. So we plan to look at student surveys where students were asked about things that their teacher, whether they care about them. So my teacher makes me feel that he or she really cares about me. My teacher seems to know if something is bothering me. And when we go through each of these, hopefully we'll be able to tease out what it is that's driving these effects.
You say it's a small boost at best. Give us an example or an understanding of just how big the boost is for these students who do see slightly better performance when they're taught by someone who looks more like them.
For sure. So the largest effect that we find for Black students, for instance, is in math among elementary age students, and it's about a month of additional learning in a school year.
Mm. We've been talking about diversity in corporate boardrooms earlier in the program. Now we're talking about a new study that has to do with diversity in the classroom and how it might help education. Joining us also is Emmanuel Alif, who's editor and partner of Tribuna newspaper. It's a trilingual publication based in Danbury. She recently participated in a ConCan community conversation on minority teacher recruitment. Emmanuel, welcome back to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
So maybe you can tell us some of the big takeaways that you have from this study and also why this is an issue that you're particularly interested in.
Well, you know, John, as a minority student myself and also in the Denver Public School System, in noticing that I did not get to see a whole lot of teachers at that point that looked like me, it's a subject that truly interests me from the get-go. And then once you look at the numbers for our state, you know, the overall state percentage of minority general education teachers is 7.9%. You know, the overall state percentage of minority school and district administrators is 12.5% for the whole state of Connecticut. And then, you know, another number in there, 127 districts in our state have zero minority administrators. So when you factor in with a lot of the conversation about educational reform and then focusing on, you know, at-risk, you know, youth and some of the schools that are failing schools, you start to look at the effects that being a minority has, where your school is located, and who is the administrator of your school, who is teaching you, and then you start making those connections.
Anna, I guess I'm wondering if you just pick up on this idea of zero minority administrators. When we have people running the schools, whether it's a superintendent or a principal, who don't look like the students that they're necessarily teaching, do we know if that has any impact at all? Does it have anything to do with the hiring? Is that something that you were able to look at?
Well, that's a great question, John. You know, 2014 was a really banner year in the U.S. This is the first time that minorities constituted a majority of public school enrollment. And so it is interesting to say, well, not just the teachers that don't look like the students, but the principals too. And it's not surprising because many administrators, I would say the majority of administrators were at one time a teacher. And so this is feeding up the pipeline. If the teachers aren't representative, then, of course, it's to be expected that the principals and administrators aren't either.
Anna, what can you tell us about language in all of this? Because obviously another piece of this is if students have parents who maybe speak a language other than English at home, it might impact what they're able to bring to the classroom. Is there any impact as far as specifically with, say, Hispanic students and teachers? Is there any better impact of having a Hispanic teacher teach a Hispanic student?
Well, we found that really difficult to study because, you know, there's huge diversity among that designation. And in these administrative data sets, we just check the box, Hispanic or not. But that's really not capturing the nuances. So students from Puerto Rico and students from Mexico may not share a cultural background that's all that similar. So it makes it more challenging to study. So we can't really speak too much about that, except to say that, you know, the theory really behind this is that the teachers may be providing that cultural bridge, not just for the students, but like you mentioned, for their families, that helps them connect better with what's happening in the classroom. And the other part to it, too, is that research that connects with ours is more focused on these subjective issues. So, for instance, teachers will give higher subjective evaluations to students that share their race. The odds that a teacher will rate a student as inattentive are a third higher if the student doesn't look like the teacher. And so that could be very much to do with cultural differences between home and school. And the odds that a teacher will rate a student as rarely completing homework also higher, 22% higher if the students are of a different race. And it's not just behaviors in the classroom. It's also these maybe unconscious biases certainly feed into teachers' views of student ability. So it has also been shown in other research that teachers hold biased views of students' academic ability if the students are of a different race. They'll rate them as having a lower scholastic aptitude.
Emmanuel, I'd love for you to pick up on that because the idea of specificity in culture is really important. You run a trilingual newspaper and you talk often in your work about the very specific differences between different members of the Hispanic community in Danbury. You don't just check a box and say, I'm Latina. You have some very specific cultural backgrounds. That's an important issue, too. It's something that maybe isn't gotten to in a study like Anna's, but it's something that we probably have to look at in the classroom.
We do, and you're right. It does matter, John. And the reason it does is, for instance, when we're referring to the Hispanic community, then we're only referring to those that speak Spanish. When we use the term Latino, then we're including, for instance, Brazilians who are Portuguese-speaking or identify as Latinos because they're part of Latin America. So all these nuances, when you're doing research-based studies, it's very difficult to categorize all of them and to be able to track them, accordingly because there's a lot of detail. But when it comes to this one issue of teacher diversity, right, and minority recruitment, there's a way to simplify it, right? Because when we're looking at now at the bulk of the diversity coming to our state, we have to look at the immigrant experience. So the question may be, are we hiring enough teachers? There are foreign teachers, for instance, in communities like, New Britain. Are we hiring enough Polish background teachers, right, in communities like Danbury? Are we hiring enough Brazilian teachers, So it could be something more of looking at the cultural competency of each professional, because in the end of the day, if we're just teaching curriculum, but we're not teaching in a way through a professional that can connect the curriculum to the real-life issues and problems and challenges that these kids have to face when they come back home, it's lost. We don't see the outcome coming back to the community as the return investment. So the important thing is to have people that are teaching our children that can identify with them, not only by the color of their skin and where they're from, but the socioeconomic struggles that they have to deal with due to their situation. For instance, a teacher who has been an immigrant or has gone through the immigration system is going to understand their unique challenges that an undocumented high school student may have in order to apply for college.
So, Emmanuel, how do we get to this? I know that you've talked about a few bills that are going through the legislature right now that actually might address this issue. Earlier in our conversation, we said, trying to get diversity into corporate boardrooms is something that people have been talking about for decades, and it's not really gotten any further. How do you get this diversity into the classroom?
It's in both subjects, it's a question of, the chicken and the egg thing, right? Because when you look at, whether we're talking about education, we're talking about boardrooms, are we are we having enough professionals rising up from these different ethnic groups in order for them to fulfill a position in a boardroom, right? So they have the quality, the training, and the capacity to serve as a board member. Are we investing enough in inspiring these children to become teachers in order for us to have a bigger pool of minority teachers so that districts can actually hire from? So I think the bigger question is, it's really connecting this piece to the long view of this issue, which is, how are we looking at minorities in general as far as investing in their future? Because there's a lot of talk about what minorities are underperforming on and what they're not yet. And there isn't a whole lot of support right now on the long view. And how can we support them to be in the future everything we expect them to be in order for some of these social issues that we're talking about no longer to be existent? Because you can't have enough African-American teachers or Spanish-speaking teachers. You know, if I, as a child, don't even remember seeing someone that looked like me in a teaching position.
Mm. You know, John, Emanuela raises great points there around recruitment. And one of the real big issues is that minorities are often the first in their families to attend college, and they might carry significant debt. And so, of course, if they've been successful and graduated with a bachelor's degree, they want to find a career that is well-paying. And for a lot of districts, that means it's difficult to attract them. They may not have flexibility to offer a starting wage that they would like to offer. And the other part, too, is that why do these programs, you know, why do teachers have to go through a traditional certification route? For some places in the country, they're experimenting with training community members to become classroom assistants first and then assisting them as they transition to becoming teachers. And that is a really good strategy to help your school faculty to look more like the students that they're serving.
So, Anna, a last question for you, though. Your study happened in Florida over the course of years. How much should we be able to draw from Florida's experience that we can directly say this is like Connecticut, and how much should we sort of take with a grain of salt? Florida is a very different place than Connecticut is.
Absolutely. Well, so that's why I think it's so important to repeat these studies. You know, replication is key. Our study was repeating a much smaller study that was done in Tennessee, and that focused on the early grades, kindergarten through third grade. And the effect sizes that we found were very similar in magnitude and very, very similar in lots of ways to what was observed there. So that is encouraging that this is something that we would expect to see in other places in the country. But I agree, our next step is to repeat this in other locations.
Emanuela, what's your next step in working towards solving some of these problems, whether it's in Danbury or statewide?
I think it's just really to continue to raise the issue, and most importantly, John, categorically on anything that has to do with education, getting parents involved and getting parents from these minority communities to understand that as taxpayers, for them to approach their school boards and say, I want to see more of teachers from my community in order to teach my children. And having really the public get involved in this issue, because in the end of the day, all of us are going to be impacted by the results, the positive and negative results of this. But it's really a question of having parents rise up and talk about this with their school districts and question. And the other key thing, too, this is not just about the benefits to minority children. I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to go to high school at Danbury High School. We have over 47 languages spoken. I've met people from all over the world at our local high school. I think that all students across the Connecticut should have the opportunity to have that kind of wealth of information attached to their education by just being exposed to diverse communities within the educational setting.
And from Anna's study, it seems as though more of this at the elementary school level probably will have the biggest impact, right?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, we don't just expect to see these positive impacts on test scores. Emanuela is talking about all kinds of things. You know, more diverse communities could be related to more tolerant individuals. We could also see things on students' non-cognitive skills, things like their socio-emotional skills, their self-esteem, their self-efficacy. So it's possible that these test score effects that we were able to study are just the tip of the iceberg.
Anna Egalite is a postdoctoral fellow in the program on education policy and governance at Harvard University. She's also the author of this new study that we've been talking about diversity in the classroom. Anna, thank you so much for your work and for your time today.
Thank you, John. Lovely chatting with you.
Thanks also to Emanuela Leaf, who's editor and partner of Tribuna Newspaper. It's a trilingual publication based in Danbury. She also participated in a community conversation on minority teacher recruitment. Always good to speak with you, Emanuela.
Thanks for having me, John.
As always, continue this conversation online at WNPR.org/where we live. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Lydia Brown. Kion Wolf is our technical producer. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon, and our executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.